You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Check out the Modern Musicology podcast, where each week we talk about things like
what makes a great drummer,
our favorite rock documentaries,
songs we love by artists we don't love,
our favorite concert memories,
songs that should have been singles,
and all of our favorite music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now.
Do not use Modern Musicology if you're allergic to it. Modern Musicology may produce itching, dizziness, vertigo, temporary blindness, or heart palpitations. Do not taunt Modern Musicology.
Ask your doctor about switching to Modern Musicology.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy that modern man has never before faced.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, this is going to be our first official episode of 2024, and we've got a special little episode in store for you on this one. It's another film involving a werewolf. Now, it's funny, and I didn't intend for this to happen, but as I look back on this eighth season of ours, we've had a number of films that deal with werewolves. And for those of you who've listened to the show quite a bit, you know, one of the running, it's a running gag, but it's actually true. Sometime later on in life, I started developing problems with pronouncing the word werewolf. So it's almost like I was forcing myself in this season to do as many films about werewolves as I could to see if I could break myself out of that. So it involves some, a little bit of extra, I would say, focus to do it. And if I slip into the bad pronunciation of werewolf, then please forgive me. But I just didn't realize how many werewolf-type movies we had done. And this one is a little different from some of the other ones we've done. I will tell you right up front, I have an affinity for this film. And I'll tell you a little bit of a story surrounding it. Now, I didn't see this film when it first came out in the theaters in 1985. Like I said, this was all surrounding a time period where I had made a major life choice and decided to move back to Georgia and set up shop there and start all over again. I moved back to Georgia from North Carolina in December of 1984. This was released midway in 1985. And so I'd been in Georgia for a while, staying with my folks, and I was working. And I was also, I had decided to study broadcasting. And so I was attending a broadcasting school, and I would later go on to work in radio for almost 30 years, doing first a drive-home show and then an afternoon show for many, many years. In fact, the majority of the time I spent on the air was doing a drive, a wake-up show, I should say, in Northwest Georgia. Then I left for a little bit when I was recruited by a newspaper and became a newspaper reporter, a crime and political reporter. Yeah, the two go together very well, don't they? Because I had quite a reputation for being a good radio journalist. And they were looking for an investigative reporter for this newspaper. I was with the newspaper for many, many years. And then just got the bug to get back behind the mic again. And went back to the small station I had been with. And developed quite a reputation there for the next 2 years. We were one of the first stations to stream, and so that gave us a little leg up over some of the local competition. And I developed quite a reputation, not only locally, but throughout the state of Georgia and the Southeast. And then I got let go from that job. Well, that happens in this business. They went for an old shock jock who replaced me in 2007. But I'm straying off the subject here. When I was living in North Carolina and I was getting near the point where I was getting make the decision to go back to Georgia, that's when I was doing the sports photography. I was a sideline cameraman for college football in that area. And of course, you know, we had North Carolina, my old alma mater, NC State, Duke, Wake Forest, ECU, and a couple other colleges nearby. And I think I mentioned this on one other episode. It just turned out that year, all of the teams were horrible. They were terrible. So nobody really wanted any footage. And it was very hard to get any work. I was freelancing with another guy. So that sort of spurred my decisions like, well, maybe I should go back to Georgia. Might be the time to do it. But before that, just before I got into that situation, I had met an incredible woman, fell madly in love with her. We were together on and off for about a year. And then she died in a car crash. And it devastated me quite a bit. That was another one of those defining moments in my life where I had to sort of pick up all the pieces and start all over again. So here I was again about a year and a half later, deciding, you know what, I think it's time for a restart. And, you know, I mean, I loved working for the big cable station I worked for and the work that I did there as not only just a cameraman, but as a producer too. I produced a lot of local content and stuff. I was involved with the theater up in that area as well. And really getting back into that, I'd been out of it for a while because it's something I'd done ever since I was a little kid. And I would just go back to Georgia, where I did get very, very, very involved with theater again, the professional theater and the regional theater. Made the decision to get into film acting and television acting. And so a lot of good things came out of that move. But what has this all got to do with Silver Bullet? Well, this gal, this wonderful gal, was a huge fan of Stephen King. And at this time, this was around 1982, 1983, I sort of knew Stephen King. I had seen Carrie, the film Carrie. I loved that movie. It may be a film that we'll talk about here on Monster Attack. I've been looking over. There's a few of Stephen's interpretations on film that I'm considering doing on this show. Because some of them are quite good. She was a huge Stephen King fan. She had just finished reading The Stand. And she was really, really getting me into Stephen King. You know, and I told her, I said, I confess, I haven't read any of his books. I'd seen the movie Carrie, not read the book it was based on. And she got me really heavy into Stephen King. So by the time I moved to Georgia, this film came out after I had moved back a few months earlier. I think this had been there about, let's see if I'm doing my math right, probably about 9 months, 6 to 9 months earlier. So when it came out, it received little publicity, which I think hurt the movie a little bit because this is a very loyal adaptation to Stephen King's novella, Cycle of the Werewolf. And I got thinking about her and I said, yeah, you know, that I need to start reading this guy. And for probably the next, I would say 5 years, I went out and got every book of Stephen King that I could find and just inhaled them. And he was definitely my favorite author during this time. There are a couple others like Michael Crichton and maybe one or two more, but King really dominated my reading life during that 5-year period. So this film I missed when it came out in the theaters. Like I said, the marketing on this was really bad. And I really had to wait until it came out on cable, and that's where I saw it for the first time. I think it was HBO. I think at the time, I think HBO was the only one that had it. But then when the VHS came out, I definitely got that, and I wore out the VHS. There was just something about this movie that I really liked, and I think looking at it, it takes place in a small town in Maine, as most of King's works do. He loves the state of Maine. It's his home state, and he centered so many of his books in that area. He really gives you interesting characters in this story. You know, as the werewolf story goes itself, it's a relatively simple story about this beast that is terrorizing this town. And like I said, it's very, very loyal to the novella. And it should be, because Stephen King wrote the screenplay as well. So this is one of those interpretations of his work that is pretty good. And that was one of the knocks that some of the movies that were based on Stephen King novels and novellas got during this time period and into the early 90s, was that there were several of them that just weren't good interpretations. And there's a few we'll talk about. I know one in particular that I'll talk about that fell into that trap. But having Stephen King do his own screenplay, I think, helped out quite a bit. Doesn't always work out that way. I have seen other films where the author also did the screenplay, and it, you know, didn't turn out that well. In this case, I think it does, and I think a lot of it is because it is so character driven, and you basically just have three main, well, I'll say four because you got to count the werewolf, but three main characters that this centers around, and that is Marty Kozlov, who is a kid who is in a wheelchair. Now, the only thing that really bothered me about this storyline was we don't really know how Marty ended up in the wheelchair. But there's some hints along the way that I believe, and I may be reading too much into this, that it may have been some kind of traffic mishap or car crash, and that maybe his mother was driving when it happened, because there's just a couple of lines that first few times I saw this movie were almost like throwaway lines, and then as I really got into this film, trying to figure out why it had such a hold on me, then I realized that there was a line in there sort of suggested that maybe his mother, Nan, played by Robin Groves, a gal who we don't know that much. I mean, she did some work in TV. A lot of the folks that you'll see in this, you'll recognize from TV. But Robin is one I didn't recognize. She had a very short career and doesn't really have much to do in this. She's more window dressing in this. But she does have this one little poignant time in the script, which would almost lead you to believe that she had some feelings of guilt over Marty's plight in the wheelchair, that maybe she was driving the car or something. And again, this is all speculation on my part, folks. Now, the fellow who plays Marty's father, Bob, is played by someone that you'll recognize, especially if you're a Star Trek fan, Leon Russom. Of course, Leon would show up in a lot of films and TV appearances throughout this time period, but I always remember him as the commander of Starfleet. He had his biggest role in that character in the Undiscovered Country, Star Trek VI. Very likable guy. And again, he and Nan, the characters of Bob Kozlov and Nan Kozlov, don't do a whole lot. They're sort of part of the family unit. They're trying to keep peace between Marty and his sister, played by Megan Follows. Megan plays the older sister, so you've got that dynamic where you've got, you know, Marty is the younger, the younger sibling, and Jane is sort of jealous of the fact that Marty gets a lot of attention because he is in a wheelchair and all that. She feels like, you know, he gets cut a lot more slack than she does, doesn't get in as much trouble as she normally would, or whatever. And now Megan may not be as familiar to American audiences as some of the others. She's going to be more recognizable by people who watch a lot of Canadian TV, because she had her signature role was playing Anne of Green Gables, and then two sequels on Canadian television from 2013 to 2017. She also starred as Catherine de' Medici, Queen of France, of course, if you're familiar with the story, and another Canadian production. So this is really one of her few American productions that's recognizable. And she's got a tough part to play. I don't want to downplay this at all, because she is plays a gal that's 14 years old, about ready to turn 15. That's a real difficult time in life for a young gal. And of course, Corey Haim is the precocious little brother that drives her absolutely nuts. He has been involved with some practical jokes that were played on her. And I'm not going to go into detail, because if you haven't seen this movie, I sort of want you to go see it, because I think you'll enjoy it. Even though I'm going to spoil it, I will warn you, I'm going to spoil all the twists and turns. But this is still a fun movie because of the people who play the characters they're playing. And you get very, very invested in these characters. You feel sorry for Jane. You can sort of feel her plight. And again, we're going to talk about the director of this film, which is also another interesting story as well. But this is going to be your main dynamic with one more character involved, and that's Uncle Red. Uncle Red is the unmarried brother of Nan Coslaw. He has had problems with the law. He's had problems in relationships. Probably drinks a little too much. And they cast the perfect person to play this role, and that's Gary Busey. Now, in 1985, Gary Busey, was quite recognizable to American audiences. Of course, from the Buddy Holly story, that's the one, everybody at this time, when I first saw the movie, I remembered him for that because I had seen him in that 7 years earlier. But he also appeared in the remake of A Star Is Born, DC Cab. Later on in life, he'd pop in and out of movies all over the place. And he always played sort of the same character that he plays in here as Uncle Red. But recently, I would say within the last 20 years, he's most recognizable for a video show that he did for the True TV Network, where they got a lot of people who had sort of problems with the law, and famous people or recognizable celebrities who had some scrapes of the law here and there, and they would watch funny videos, and then they would make some funny comments about that, almost like Mystery Science Theater 3000, except with little video clips that were sent into them by people like America's Funniest Home Videos. And Gary was always a sight. He did have a very serious motorcycle accident several years ago, which nearly killed him. It led to the state of California passing more strict laws on the wearing of motorcycle helmets. If I'm not mistaken, I think at that time they didn't require helmets by motorcycle riders. So Gary is something else. He's a nut. And he's a nut in this with Uncle Red, and very close to Marty and Jane. They think the world, of course, Marty absolutely worships him. And because in this movie and in the story too, in the book as well, Uncle Red has built Marty a motorized wheelchair, and we see it early on in the movie. But he is getting ready to unveil a new wheelchair that he calls the Silver Bullet. And it is something else. You could almost imagine a wheelchair that can travel as fast as a motorcycle, because it uses a motorcycle engine, and a small motorcycle engine, probably a 125. And it's just, it makes Marty's day. And it's got a lot to do with the storyline here. Now, some of the other people, let's mention real quickly some of the other people you're going to see in this. Everett McGill, who I will always remember from Twin Peaks, but he several memorable television appearances in addition to Twin Peaks. He was in Quest for Fire before that. He appeared in Dune the year before this film came out. Then he did Silver Bullet, Heartbreak Ridge, Iguana, License to Kill. But I always remember him for Twin Peaks. He had a memorable role in that memorable television series as well. And he plays a reverend in this. Now, in the book, he's a Catholic priest. In the film, he's a reverend of the town church. And they don't really assign any kind of denomination to it. So he's overlooking this town that is encountering these strange murders, and again, when we get into the timeline, we'll talk a little more about that, trying to hold the town together through all of this pain and tragedy. Terry O'Quinn plays the sheriff, Sheriff Joe Haller. Terry O'Quinn, I will always remember him for several television shows. Of course, the one most people my age and younger remember him for is playing John Locke on the TV series Lost. He was on the entire run from 2004 to 2010. But I first saw him in two slasher movies, which we won't review on this show, The Stepfather and Stepfather Part Two. And he would pop up here and there in all kinds of different roles. I mean, he showed up on X-Files and Millennium and films, or I mean, TV shows that I watched quite a bit during this time period. Very likable character. And he's sort of caught between a rock and a hard place because these people are dying in this town. He's trying to figure out, you know, he's treating this like a serial killing. And, you know, the people in the town are demanding he do something about it and catch this guy. So there's another big dynamic there as well. Another familiar face you're going to see is Lawrence Tierney, who owns the local bar. Again, this is a small town, so a little pub that everyone hangs out in. Owen Knopfler. And Lawrence Tierney, of course, you know, he's the older brother of Scott Brady. Lawrence was known for playing mobsters and bad guys. I mean, I think his most memorable role in my book is Reservoir Dogs, where he played, you know, Big Joe in that. But, you know, Lawrence Tierney is Lawrence Tierney. And in this film, he's got this baseball bat called the Peacemaker. And that comes into play later on. And it's not like a purchased baseball bat. It almost looks like one that he may have whittled or made himself. It's huge. It's huge. For the most part, all the other people you see in this, you're not really going to recognize. There may be a few people here and there you might say, oh, I think I may have seen them on TV or whatever. But, you know, for the most part, these are going to be your major players. Now, I want to talk about the director of this, and his name is Daniel Attias. And Daniel was known for directing a lot of television. He directed several episodes and actually won a directing award for The Wire. He also directed episodes of The Sopranos, 6 Feet Under, Homeland, to name a few. He's still directing. He had never directed a feature film. And the amazing thing about this is his first and only feature film. It's unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable. I'm surprised that he hasn't been picked by producers to do another film. He does a nice job on this. He really does. I mean, and like I said, he's still directing. You know, if you're a fan of the TV series Rabbit Hole, Billions, which I loved, directed some three episodes of that. Penny Dreadful, which I loved, the second Penny Dreadful, the one that took place in Los Angeles. Just a really all-around good director. Close to 100 directing credits on television. Well, let's say, you know, minus one, and that's this one feature film. I'm really stunned at how well this has turned out. So let's talk a little bit about the story here as we get into the heart of things here. Now we know who our people are. And again, small town in Maine. We've met Marty. We've met Jane. This is at a local, like, sort of fair that's going on in the town. Marty's friend plays a practical joke on Jane, who is trying to break out of the little girl, maybe the little bit of tomboy role that she'd been playing. That's the impression I got. And again, I'm really amazed at how Steven's writing and Daniel Attias is directing with very little information given to the audience can really flesh these characters out pretty well. But I saw Jane as a tomboy type who now she's at this age where she's going to turn 15, probably a sophomore in high school, getting very interested in boys and wanting to break loose of doing the tomboy type stuff and getting more into, going out with boys and that sort of thing and developing as a woman. And so she's dressed to the nines for this festival. and it's the first time she's wearing hose. Now, I grew up with sisters, so I know that's sort of a big deal for gals that age. And Marty's friend ends up playing this practical joke with a snake on Jane, which forces her to fall into a big mud puddle and ruin her hose and ruin her outfit. And, of course, just crushing stuff. And Marty is not a bad brother in this. You know, he didn't want him to go. He thought his friend went too far. Friend's name was Brady. But he was there. So she blames him. And then later that night, he does show up at Jane's bedroom and puts some money on her nightstand and says it's for a new pair of hose and all that. And in just these little moments between Jane and Marty, we see that there is quite a love between those two. You know, yeah, he may be the little brother that drives her crazy, but there's still a lot of love in this family between the two of them. And, you know, yeah, maybe there's a little bit of jealousy over the attention he gets because of his situation. But it's a tight relationship, and that goes to work in this show so heavily. It's a very, very important part of this. So we have, in the very beginning of the film, we have our first murder. And it occurs on a train track. Got a guy who's, I don't want to call him the town drunk, but he's played by James Gammon. He's a guy you're going to recognize. He's in a ton of stuff and a ton of movies and TV work. I will always remember him, always remember James Gammon as being the manager of the hapless baseball team in Major League. And that ought to just, that should light the light bulb for just about anybody my age or younger. It was such a funny movie, and he was so good in that. But he's working on the railroad, and he gets attacked by some kind of beast. We pretty much know it is it's a werewolf, but we don't see him yet. We hear him snarling. We see it's a point of view shot from the werewolf, which, again, this was starting to catch on now in 80s films, where the monster or the beast would you'd see it from their point of view. And he's attacked and killed. The next month, a woman by the name of Stella Randolph is preparing to kill herself. Now, in the book, which has everyone being Catholic, this is serious stuff. It's considered the unforgivable sin. And she's pregnant. We see a quick scene where Marty has seen her. He's been flying his kite, and it gets stuck in a tree. And I mean, this kid does great. He climbs up and down trees. You'd never know he couldn't walk except for the wheelchair. And but he overhears this conversation between Stella and her boyfriend, who says, "No, I'm not. I don't want to have anything to do with it or all that." And so she decides the only thing she can do is to kill herself, and she's killed by the werewolf. I mean, he stalks her. She's in her bedroom, ready to do the deed, and doesn't get a chance to do it because he breaks into the house and kills her almost immediately. And again, these murders aren't just killings. I mean, they're slaughters. Now, parents, if you're going to watch this movie with a young child, I think this may be not the right movie for a very young child. Let's keep it maybe in the early teens and up. There's not a lot of blood, but there is blood in this, and there is violence in this. So again, you get more descriptions of how people are torn apart by this werewolf. And again, when you got a movie that leaves a lot to your imagination, that makes it, you know, 10 times more horrifying. So now you've got these first two murders. They happen every month. Now, the book took place over a year's time with it. Each chapter was a different killing. So there are 12 chapters in the book, in the novella. It was only 127 pages long, which any of you who've read Stephen King, that's pretty short. But he was very good. He wrote some very good novellas, including the one that the movie Stand By Me was based on. So now the town's getting a little scared, locking themselves in. They're not used to doing this. We have a quick scene with Marty and a gal who he has eyes for. And she likes him too, but she's from the wrong side of the tracks. She lives on the wrong side of town. She has an abusive father. And he doesn't like the fact that she's hanging around with a quote-unquote cripple. You know, makes a big deal out of that. He has these big greenhouses near his dilapidated house where they live. We never see her mother, so we don't know. I don't know if the mother's alive or if he's raising her by himself. But you know immediately he's a bad guy. Drinks too much, all of that. And he's killed in his greenhouse. I mentioned the kite flying incident. Marty's best friend Brady is flying his kite during the same time, and Marty has to get home and tells Brady, he says, "Hey, are you going?" Or he says, "No, I'm going to stay a little while longer." And, you can see what's going to happen. Brady gets killed by the werewolf. And, you know, I've said this so many times that, you know, in movies, even during this time period, you don't kill dogs or cats and you don't kill kids. You don't see it. So it's that much more horrific because they went that route in the story, and but you don't see it, fortunately. I think it would have been way too much if they had shown it. And this is one thing that I'm sort of thankful that they haven't tried to reboot Silver Bullet. If they have, I'm not aware of it. It's probably that bad. I don't think you can reboot this movie because a modern director would want to show too much, and this would be a classic example of it. Now, this is a turning point of the movie with Brady's death because now the town is in an uproar. They don't believe that the sheriff is capable of solving this crime. And they get together, a vigilante group, and they're going to go get it. And this is sort of, you know, almost a takeoff on the scene from Jaws when they put out the reward for the person who can catch the shark. And all that, you know, it's almost a comic scene when all the people go out, you know, in their fishing boats to go get the shark. Very similar thing. We've seen this done a lot in other films of this nature. And so it's in at night, because that's when this werewolf attacks, is at night. Man, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't do it if I was living in this town. The Reverend Lowe tries to, talk them out of it. Don't do this. We don't need any more bloodshed or whatever, but they're going to go hunt the killer. And three of them are attacked and killed in the woods. One of the survivors said he didn't see anything unusual because there was this bank of fog that was there. Remember the show we did on the prophecy, you know, about the mutated bear. And they had a scene in there too, where they had a low-lying fog. You couldn't tell if anything's underneath it or not. And this was almost an homage to Jaws again, I think, because it's like, you know, and I'm sure that influenced Stephen King when he wrote this, because it's taking people out. They can't see it. They'd be standing there and also they're pulled under the fog, and then another, and then another. And it leads, this is like one of the best scenes in the whole movie. That attack scene, because you feel so helpless. Where are you going to run? This fog is everywhere. This thing could be anywhere because it's going underneath the fog. But it leads us to another scene. So you're going to have two back-to-back scenes here that are like a 1-2 combination. That's a scene showing Reverend Lowe once again officiating at a funeral, this time for three people that were killed. And he's looking very strange, and he looks out into the congregation. And Brady's father yells at him about, you know, how he can't catch this thing. And all of a sudden, all of the people in the congregation start turning into werewolves. And then he wakes up from a nightmare. You sort of know that's coming, but the first time I saw this, it was done so well. Daniel Attias does a great job of this, because you're not sure if this is really happening or if it is a dream. And then it is a dream, but it's okay. It's done very, very well. Now, I will say on a generalized note, I like the werewolf costume and a lot of the makeup they do in this film. Dino De Laurentiis, who was the producer of this, yeah, we got another Dino De Laurentiis film that's shot in Wilmington, North Carolina. He had just built his studios up there before this. This is one of the first films he shot, on his sound stages and locations in Wilmington. He wasn't too crazy, but he wasn't crazy about the way the wolf was being represented in the film. And kept arguing with Carlo Rambaldi, who was doing his special effects makeup again. But Carlos and Daniel said, no, this is how we want it done. And so Dino gave in because it was like, hey, we're not going to do the film if you're not going to let us do it the way we want to do it. So now that takes us, we're in this film where you're trying to figure out who's the werewolf. It's a very, very common vehicle. The unsolved murders just more and more and more. They got curfews in place. And the 4th of July celebration is canceled. So no fireworks this year. The Coslaws have their own, their own backyard party with Uncle Red. And that's when Red gives Marty this custom built wheelchair / motorcycle. It really is a motorcycle. Called the Silver Bullet. And Marty goes nuts. Now, not only that, but before Red leaves to go home that night, he gives Marty a bag of fireworks and says, here, you can have your own 4th of July. So Marty sneaks out one night. It's amazing what he can do. Not having legs, or he has legs, but not having legs at work, that doesn't keep him down at all. He sneaks out, starts launching rockets. Guess what? It's night. And guess who shows up? This is when we see the werewolf. And the other way Marty is able to escape is he's got a skyrocket. He fires right at the wolf, hits him right in the eye, full on with the skyrocket. And it gives Marty time to escape. So now Marty goes to Jane and he tells her that he's seen this werewolf. He's seen it. And he wants Jane to help him find out who it is. Somebody in this town is going to have an eye injury. And I won't go into all the details that Jane does decide to help out, how she goes about finding out who it is, but she finds out who it is because she is she's helping with this pop bottle and Coke can drive that the church is having. And the next time we see Reverend Lowe, he's got a big bandage on his eye. Wow. And she's able to get away from the Reverend without any suspicions being raised. But tells Marty about it. Marty starts sending anonymous notes to the Reverend Lowe, saying you need to kill yourself. Lowe figures out who it is that's sending him the notes. We've got a great chase scene where he tries to run Marty off the road, and Marty gets trapped in this old covered bridge that's been condemned, and it almost looks like that Lowe is going to swoop in on him and get him when one of the townspeople comes by in their tractor on the other side of the bridge, and Marty's able to get his attention and make it seem like he's trapped in there because of the motorcycle wheelchair got stuck. So that leaves Jane and Marty no choice but to go to Uncle Red. Uncle Red thinks they're crazy. But little by little, they wear him down and they get him convinced that maybe there's something to this story. They each have a silver medallion. And I have to assume it may be one that someone gave them, like their mother or something. And they melt down the medallions. Guess what? Yeah, they're silver, into a silver bullet. Again, there's a lot of cool details that go on with this. Now, Red, before he commits to helping them try to kill this werewolf, does go to the sheriff, and he tells him the story, and he says, look, I don't know what to believe. I don't know if it's true or not. And the sheriff is like, yeah, that's pretty crazy stuff. But he says, I'll go check it out. Because here he is, you got the sheriff. Yeah, this is Terry O'Quinn. He's desperate. He needs to get a killer here. He's got to solve this case. And so he pays Reverend Lowe a visit. Well, Reverend Lowe's nowhere around. But Holler manages to to get into his garden shed where he keeps all of the cans and bottles for this drive. And it just turns out that Reverend Lowe is in there locked into this shed, something that he would do to prevent him from killing anybody when he turns into a wolf. Boy, talk about being in the wrong place at the wrong time. There goes our sheriff. And he's killed with the baseball bat that Lawrence Tierney was one of the three that got killed when they went out hunting the werewolf. That's the other thing that allowed Jane to sort of know that it was Reverend Lowe who was the werewolf, in addition to the eye patch. And Haller. Haller knew something was up when he saw that baseball bat, because everybody knew about that. So now Marty and Jane, they finally convince Uncle Ray. They said, look, we've got to do something about this. You know, the sheriff's now been missing. They've got this silver bullet. Red comes up with this plan that makes it sound like that Nan and Bob have won this honeymoon trip, this romantic getaway, and Red's going to take care of them. You know, he's going to babysit the kids while the parents are off on this wonderful excursion. And they're going to wait for the werewolf because they know he's going to be coming after them. He knows it. He says there's no way around it. And I'm not going to go into detail on this, but it's a great scene that reminds me, I mean, the whole area, this whole time period here reminds me of the attack scene in The Return of Count Yorga. That kind of tension. There's a storm going on. You know, the three of them are, you know, trying to stay awake. All of a sudden, Jane sees the wolf looking in the window, freaking out. The wolf does break in. There's a scramble for the gun. A little bit of business with getting the bullet loaded into the gun and all that. And Marty ends up with the gun and shoots the Reverend dead on in his other eye, killing the werewolf. And then we see the transformation back to the Reverend Lowe. And there's a nice little scene to wrap this up. Some people might find it a little cheesy. I thought it was very charming because it sums up the whole relationship between Jane and Marty, which is really at the crux of this whole story, where she can actually say she loves him for the first time. She's not the kind, you get the impression throughout the whole movie, she's not the kind of person who would do that. But she does that time, and she also is a narrator in this film. The narration is actually done by Tova Feldschun. Does a great job. Does a great job on the narration on that, as a grown-up Jane thinking back on the story, relaying the story years later. There's just something about this film, folks, that I really, really like. The characters are very engaging. At times, it's a very, very sweet story, and it is such a different approach to your traditional werewolf type story, then I'm going to recommend it. Again, not for small children. And I will warn mom and dad, there's, I think, two little quick scenes where there's a couple of nasty words thrown out, which are sort of obligatory. You know, they could almost take them out and it wouldn't hurt the film at all. But this was the mid-80s, and that kind of thing was done quite a bit, unfortunately, in a lot of these 80s films. You had to sneak one of those words in somewhere along the way. But Silver Bullet, it's just one of those films that it's always had a hold of me, and I enjoy it every time I see it. Now I've got it on DVD. My VHS got destroyed in the storm that I talk about all the time. But one of my family members gave me the Stephen King collection, DVD collection that came out several years ago. And it's one of those. And it's just, I should get the Blu-ray, because this is available on Blu-ray. It's available on streaming, but you're going to have to pay a couple bucks for it to see it. But I think it's well worth a look. And I think it's an underappreciated film. It got mixed reviews when it came out in the theater, about 50-50, good versus bad. But I just love the telling of this story, and it's very watchable for an hour and a half. It packs a wallop, and they do a nice job. And again, I'm surprised that Daniel Attias does not direct more feature films, but he has found a niche. For what he's done, he's one of the most prolific television directors we have nowadays. So Silver Bullet from 1985. It'll be celebrating its 40th anniversary next year. Hey, folks, we've started a new year, not a new season. The season changeover to season number 9 will be coming up in a few months away. We appreciate all the support you've shown us over the craziness that we had in season 7. It's been a little better there here in season 8. We've had a lot more fun now without any interruptions. And we've got some more co-hosts lined up for you down the road here. And looking forward to seeing you next Monday for an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Have a great week, folks. We'll see you then.
All right, monkeying around, start talking. About your podcast.
We talk about an Emmy-winning comedy series.
We talk about a band who outsold Beatles and the Stones in 1967.
Still sticking to that story, huh? Well, if you know what's good for you, you'll change your tune.
We talk about a groundbreaking multimedia project
that inspired generations of artists and fans.
All right, throw the book at them.
This book is overdue.
Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.